Welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and I have a special guest for you guys today. This is somebody that I met on Facebook, but usually it was in through some comments that were going back and forth between people. And I kept seeing some of these links that he would send, and I went and looked at it, and I was like, what is this? So our guest is Michael Bull. He's an Australian author, theologian, and graphic designer based in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney, Australia. He is the creator and editor of the Bible Matrix, a project exploring the literary and structural DNA of scripture through chiastic and typological patterns that he believes reveal the unified design of God's word. Bull's work blends biblical theology with symbolic interpretation, emphasizing covenantal structure and temple imagery across both testaments. He has written several books, including Bible Matrix, An Introduction to the DNA of the Scriptures, and operates Bull's Bible School in Kenya, which supports biblical education for pastors and leaders. His writings reflect a postmillennial and covenantal hermeneutic rooted in a high view of biblical typology and fulfillment. And so without further ado, introducing Mr. Michael Bull. Hello, Michael.
G'day, how you going, Rick? From memory, the first comment you responded to of mine, I was just particularly rude.
Oh yeah.
I think I sort of snapped back at something somebody said, and your response, I just was so gracious. I thought, wow, that's how I need to interact today. I just, you know.
Well, so, I mean, and you explained yourself, you know, you go to the pub and you have some words with people, and yeah, then you shake hands and go home. But when we're online, we don't get to do the shaking hands part.
Well, no, that's right. And as I like to say, if we were doing this, we're debating over beers at a pub, we could have an actual brawl.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would probably be even kinder in that situation.
Oh, you would. I have no doubt you would. Yeah. Look, there's certainly a place for that. Yep, definitely.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I really appreciate you being willing to take your time up. I know you're 16 hours ahead of me. It's about 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time here, so that puts you up pretty late. What time is it there?
It's just past 10 p.m. But look, this is no. But after 9 p.m. for me is prime time. So
oh, good.
That's when I'm sharpest. That's when I get my best work done. So you know, it's very good.
Yep. Yeah, and as my great friend Elaine Clark, she lives in Spain, but she's English, and she says, yep, "I'm ready and cracking to go, Rick."
yeah, that's it. Let's get cracking. Yeah, we use that one. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Good.
Well, yeah. One of the things that I asked you up front is that I just for a little bit, I'd just like to hear a little bit of your story about how you came into the faith, because all of us have a similar story where we meet Jesus somewhere in our life and our lives begin to change. And so can you tell me a little bit about that?
I was raised in the Anglican Church. I sort of, there were some pretty, what's the word? I know there were real Christians in the church. But I think for my family, it was pretty nominal. So, you know, it's just something that they always did. And that was good. I mean, even at that stage, they were still using sort of a bit of the old liturgy, that they would recite. You know, we'd read it off cards. And of course that when you were saying something like that every week, it stays with you. So we went to Sunday school and, you know, learned all the Bible stories. I think I went to an Anglican school from year five and private school. That was good. I think I was just really searching when I got into high school. Mm-hmm. And I thought the answer's in here somewhere. And looking back, I think that had to be the Lord, because only the Lord can give you that sort of desire to not just, you know, most students were just like, yeah, it's okay, it's just culture. You know, we had chapel services at school, and in reasonably impressive looking chapel. It was a pretty old school, it was like 100 years old at the time, I think. And I had a few teachers who were vocal Christians, which was fine. It was part of the school culture, and I remember asking them questions, and I kind of struggled with assurance. And then I met some very I actually dropped out of school. I didn't finish school. I just couldn't cope a lot with a lot of it. I found out years later that I have Asperger's, but that wasn't until my 40s. So, I did
Wow.
some, did really well in some things at school and terribly in others, and just yeah. But then anyway, I went and got a job in a print shop, which I absolutely loved. And one of the ladies there, who was the graphic artist kind of person at, well, the way things were then before desktop publishing, she and her husband used to do these Christian talks. He'd put these slideshows together on different things, and they'd go and visit people's homes and friends and have these talks. And I thought, wow, I really dig this stuff. They were real rough diamonds and a bit odd, but and there was one guy there who was reformed, and I thought, oh, I really like the way this guy talks about stuff, Anyway, so that sort of got me into the riff. So the sort of the into the reformed stuff. But it was in the late 80s, I just remember picking up by accident David Chilton's Revelation commentary in a Christian bookstore, which I still think is really weird that they had it. Like it was a pretty run-of-the-mill sort
The
of a Christian
Days of
bookstore.
Vengeance, Days of
And
Vengeance, right?
that's yeah, that's the one. And I remember reading it and thinking, wow, I was familiar with a historicist, viewpoint on Revelation, but when I was reading this, I thought, this makes sense. This guy's tying it all together. He's actually making sense of things. And so that sort of got me on that path. Eventually, that led me eventually to James Jordan, and I listened to his Revelation lectures, and that's where he shared these patterns, the creation pattern, which is relates to the pattern of the Israel's annual feasts. And also to the way he used Revelation to go back to as a window on the whole Bible, basically, just to go back and show where all of these things were like hyperlinks. And I thought I'd listened to a few other people on Revelation. I mean, that I was familiar with Chilton, Gentry, some Gary DeMar. Listening to Jordan and the way he dealt with the imagery, I thought he's nailed it. Like, this is it for me. Like, yeah. So, and then I was on their forum for quite a few years. They're really lovely, gracious guys. They put up with me, which was very nice. So look, that's basically, it. I think it's just, I think I've always Chilton's book just showed me the power of scripture. I think that was the thing. It's like, right, this guy he's not just taking verses and building on those. He's actually showing how the whole thing works. And I think Jordan took that to the next level for me. So
I
yeah, that
noticed
was it. And
that,
then of course
yeah.
I just have this thing. Someone said, Michael, you just can't help teaching. You just don't shut up, like So, and I was teaching with a bunch of other guys at the local high school. We still have some Bible teaching in public schools here. There's people trying to get rid of it, but it's still, it's still hanging on. And yeah, just sharing some of this stuff with unchurched high school kids, and they got it. They seem to get it better than some Christians do. So that was fun. Did that for quite a while. But anyway, so yeah, it's just been, blogging and whatever. I've got quite a few friends who are much more well read than I am, and they're very helpful. They'll say, oh, well, such and such said that, and I thought, oh, that's good to know. They're very much appreciated. Yeah, but anyway, it's look, the Bible's just such an exciting book. It's just there's always more to see, and and I think the biggest thing I try to get across to people is that it does, the Bible has a very ironic sense of humor, and sometimes we just don't get the jokes.
Yeah, you know what?
It's
That is the case for me. I noticed, when I saw, and we'll get into this in a little bit about the shape of, the things that you write, like of Isaiah and of Deuteronomy. Those are things that are lost on us, in our English translations. We don't see it. We don't see how, how it was written out. We don't, and I say we, I mean those of us who are uneducated, in Hebrew, or in Greek, or how the Hebrew mind worked and how they, spoke with one another and how their writings worked. And so I knew when I first saw your work, I was like, okay. And I had read James Jordan's Handwriting on the Wall, and I remember my first take on James Jordan was, this guy is on a level I don't even know where to begin with this, because he's seeing things I didn't see. But I like the way that he presents it. He's such a he. There's a lot of humility there, and I like how the way that he shares it and gives it. He wants everyone to see what he's seeing, and I see that in you too. I know that you can be, to take a pun on your name, bullish. I know you can be at times like, nope, this is how it is. But also I can understand where you are, where you've been educated so far in your life, that you want to share it so that people can actually see it, so that they can miss some of the pitfalls that a lot that we get, you know, in the world today, especially in, you know, theology circles.
Yeah, I've mellowed a lot.
Yeah.
I look at some of the stuff I wrote maybe 10 years ago and I think, oh, Michael, like there's just no patience that, you know. I mean, I don't attack people, but I tend to attack ideas, but people
Right,
don't,
absolutely.
you know. And if someone comes at me full on, I just take it as, oh, okay, I need to defend my position. It's all very it's not personal, you know. So but I'm becoming, you know, more patient, and also too, I think just realizing, and Peter Lighthart's been an influence on me in that regard. He's just so patient and gracious with people of different opinions, and he's you know, look, we all are brothers and sisters, and we all are helping each other along. Theology is a group project. Everybody's got something to offer. And to recognize that, and then, and you know, to not be as sort of as confrontational as I used to be, or put it another way, to be confrontational, but to wrap it in grace. You know, just like it's like, look, and that's to me, it's that sort of takes a bit of time. I just want to get right to the point. That's my thing. It's not that I'm trying to be rude. It's just like here it is. But you know, none of us really respond to that really well. So
It
yeah, but
reminds
also too,
me of the
my thing is to
story.
just encourage. Sorry.
I'm
Go
sorry, I
ahead.
didn't mean, it reminds me of that story where, you know, it's a novel about the world in 2D, and then suddenly a 3D object shows up in that 2D world, and they're trying to
Oh.
define it. Sometimes when I see your comments, like I'll see a comment come in and I'll think, he's in the 3D world. Like, I don't understand. Like, I'm going to need you to explain that sphere to me because I see a circle. And so that's what it feels like sometimes with people like Jordan or you or Lightheart. I mean, like you said, the patience and the kindness goes a long way. It helps us. But there's sometimes when I see things and I'm like, okay, I'm uneducated. I don't understand what that sphere is. I can't, you know, I need you to help me see that. And that's why I wanted to meet you and talk to you, because I'm fascinated by this. And I, you know, and the other reason why I really wanted to meet you is because of a response you gave to me. I said to you, I said, you know, Michael, the reason I'm a full preterist and I have reasons why. It's not because I'm being obstinate. It's not because I just want to be right. It has nothing to do with any of that. It's that I've seen something now, the imminency of those particular time texts hit me and mattered to me. And then when I saw it being able to be shown in a fulfilled light, it didn't make sense to me in my physical reality. It didn't make sense to me because I was like, I have a like this disconnect between my physical reality and what I know to be true spiritually. But I also saw that in the scriptures too, when Jesus would talk to like the woman at the well or talk to his disciples and say things and they just weren't getting it. And I thought, perhaps that's what's happening to me. And so that's why I was being honest with you. And I was like, there's a reason why I am this way. And, you know, I believe
Oh,
that I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ with all of my heart. He saved me, the wretch that I was, and he has remained with me. And I'm reading this to be true. And I'm like, okay, I know that I can learn and grow. I know that happens. I get that. So I want to talk to Michael and see what it is that you're seeing and why you're so vehemently opposed to this idea, and then just get a good grasp of it. That's why I wanted to meet you to start with, you know?
Oh
So.
no, and I look, I really appreciate that. I believe that the structure of the Bible is the answer to the question, because God works in the same way all the time. He in the same sequence. It's a sequence of specified steps that he takes, which the first time we see it is in Genesis 1, and that sets the foundation for everything that he does. And So it was, Jordan sort of picking up on this thing. He sort of saw this pattern as sort of quite common in scripture, but I see it as ubiquitous. Like the entire thing is like Leviathan scales. Like this pattern is working at every level simultaneously. It's in a like a fractal,
Yes.
it's like broccoli, I like to say, Romanesco broccoli. It's the same pattern at every level, and there's no part of it that is not following this structure in some way. It's like a crystalline pattern, and it explains why the text is often weird and jumps around and has abrupt changes, and it seems like a shambles sometimes. Yeah, looking at I've been working on Isaiah, and just that book, it just looks like it was thrown together because there's no discernible rhyme or reason for its arrangement. And yet I thought, based on what I got from Chilton, it's like no, that's not the right attitude. There's something going on here.
Yes.
And the Lord does that. He doesn't tell you. He just it's like he's like a good the best movie directors just kind of show you stuff and like, okay, you figure it out. Like, what's actually happening here? You put the pieces together. I want you to think. I want you to join the dots, So I think that structure is the answer to the debate over full preterism versus partial preterism. And it shows where the full preterists are right over the partial preterists, and the partial preterists have been accused of being inconsistent, where the same language is used, and they say, "Oh no, that's talking about different events," and that's clearly not the case. Like, there's using the same language would indicate that they're talking about the same event. However, the same structure also shows where full preterists where they sort of where they fall apart. Like, it doesn't go far enough. It shows that there are some texts that they have to truncate into AD 70 that actually don't, and they're not the texts that are sort of the partial preterists, some of them try to claim, but there are it's it, but the main thing too is just the architecture of the whole thing shows you that God does work in layers, and why there are numerous instances where, and also the symmetrical shape of sacred history, that show that's this to be the case. There is an architecture, and it's the same thing you see in miniature in the shape of Isaiah, and well, in any biblical book really, they all follow basically the same structure. There's a few variations on it, usually to make some kind of point, but once you'd see it, it is like suddenly putting on 3D glasses, and all of a sudden, oh, this is a pop-up book. This book's not flat. This book has a shape. And once you know the tune, once you know the pattern, then you start to see it. And of course, the best thing for me was like seeing Jordan show how Revelation follows Israel's annual harvest calendar, and also the pattern of conquest from Genesis to Judges, and all of those things are the same process expressed in different media, whether it's the calendar or the architecture of the tabernacle or whatever. And then, of course, it's sometimes he will say things, and other people have mentioned this as well. Jordan will say something, and you think, "Nah, that's crazy." Now, sometimes I think he is crazy. I don't agree with him on everything. But the funny thing is the way that the reasons that I in places where I disagree with him, it's because I'm applying other things that I've learned from him, and I'm a systems guy. He's sort of like, oh look, here's the pattern again, and it's all a bit casual, whereas I'm like, no, this is absolutely crystalline, and there are no gaps. That is the guardrails or the train tracks of the scriptures that keep the interpreter on the path. Like, the structure is the container that is a channel of meaning as well. So the location of something is given its meaning by it gives it something its meaning. So if you look at Revelation, for instance, instead of just being a bunch of random stuff that it talks through, it's meticulously working through this pattern, and And you once you know the sequence, you kind of go, oh, this should be next. Oh, there it is. But also too, you look at it and go, oh, I see what you did there. I knew what was coming next in general terms, but now I see what you've done with it in this particular for this particular purpose. And it's God is the best at writing sequels. When people want a sequel, they want the same experience again, but it has to be a totally different story. And which is pretty hard to pull off. But God does it every time. Every new development in scripture, it's really the same thing again, but in a totally different way. And he takes it to the next level. He ups the stakes. And generally the devil does that as well. My favorite example is before the flood, the Cainites basically abolished worship. Like they stopped sacrificing. Sin was paid for with blood. It was vengeance. That was it. But after the flood, the devil's tack changed, and it was the Tower of Babel. It was false religion, and that sort of started syncretism. So, the devil ups his game as well. And so, but what the Lord does is it's because the devil keeps upping his game, and we see it happening today as well. God's people have to develop with new wisdom each time. So when people say, well, cultural Marxism's not Marxism. Like, no, it's more subtle. It's the same thing, but he's coming at us from a different angle. How, you know, the, say same-sex marriage, and then all of a sudden we have to say, oh, how do we defend marriage? We always just took that as a given. We have to go back to this drawing board, so God just keeps throwing curve balls. And Billy gets the devil to do it, So
That's
these
for
things
sure.
come in, and we yeah and it also too tends to purify the church. Allowing a serpent into the garden is always for our ultimate benefit. That's the key. It's as I like to say, the book of Genesis is just a game of snakes and ladders. Like, you've got the serpent in the garden, and then you've got Jacob's ladder. And the thing with the Bible is that the snakes often look like ladders, and the ladders often look like snakes. And you have to, you the only way you can discern between them is by what God told you. And otherwise, the things don't always look like what they are. I mean, the serpent in the garden offered a ladder. Hey, you can be like God, but he was a serpent. So, it's a lot of fun. And the good thing is that the Bible's really consistent once you sort of figure out how to join the dots and how these sequence God recapitulates things all the time, the same sequences. So once you sort of see it, it's you and Peter Lighthart said that too. He said, it's like getting a joke. You make the connection in your mind, like the comedian leaves something out, but it's something that he knows that and you make the connection, and then you go, oh, I get it. And he said, that's why a good interpretation is less like dissecting a frog than it is like getting a joke. It's not, we're not just taking this thing apart. You actually have to have a sort of a sense of humor or something that can put these things together, because the Bible does that. It doesn't spoon feed us all the time.
Do you ever feel like your soap is doing more harm than good? Well, I did too. Then I found Halfback Mountain Soaps. Born from one person's search for a better bar of soap, these are as pure as a mountain stream. No chemicals, no drying agents, just simple, skin-loving ingredients like shea butter, olive oil, coconut oil, and castor oil. Each bar is handcrafted and scented naturally with things like lavender, cinnamon spice, and sweet lemongrass. Here is a great tip. Grab 5 bars, and they will toss in a handcrafted wooden soap dish too. That dish helps your soap last longer because it dries out between uses. With free shipping on orders over $75, it's easy to stock up or give them as a gift. Take a deep breath, scrub with something real, and feel the difference. Visit halfbackmountainsoap.com today and bring the mountain into your bathroom. Also, you can use code BURROWS10 and get 10% off of your first order.
That's something that Kim Burgess had done. Kim Burgess did a podcast and a book with Gary DeMar, and he said rather than dissection, he did vivisection, where instead of pulling the things out, then you have the singular and it's no longer the frog. You actually open it up and you watch the system that makes it as the whole frog. It's kind of like you're saying, getting the joke, but he says the very same thing that you do, or he'll say the scriptures is like a diamond with many different facets. You can look at it from a facet, but that's not the whole diamond. You have to remember the whole. And so it's very, sometimes it's very, it feels daunting, like a very daunting task to get the whole picture, right? You said it's really, that's one of the things I've told the other, whenever I was with my cast in the Burrows, is that writing, I said, when you look at the scriptures, it's like writing on super steroids. It's a totally different kind of and style of writing. It shows the level. It's yet another thing that tells me that it's divine, that it comes from the Lord. It's so powerful. And that's why I really wanted to understand it. And I wanted to ask you a question in regard to something you said earlier. You probably know I have a dear friend, Tim Martin, who wrote with J.L. Vaughan the book Beyond Creation Science, and they have this. It's called Covenant Creation, and they invited me to speak at their conference, knowing that I'm not a covenant creationist. And I, of course, I brought my view there, and we were comparing notes and talking. But there was one thing that I always enjoyed about Tim and those guys is that they saw something in Genesis 1, a template as well. And so it kind of resounds whenever I hear James Jordan say it or you say it. People are seeing a template and they're applying it. And so I'm just curious, like you've encountered people within covenant creation. I'm not trying to get you into any kind of argument with anybody, but I'm just curious, what is
Oh,
it?
no. And I think I can understand how they came to their conclusion. And this is where I think this is where both sides fail, because they're relying on proof texting all the time, generally speaking, and trying to put the puzzle together. And so they because the prophets and of course Revelation uses sort of cosmic language to describe local events, and the Old Testament prophets did that as well. They read that back, as you know, into Genesis 1 and say, well, the world already existed, and this was God giving a covenantal purpose to all of these things, which is a fair enough assertion, because they rely on Jordan's idea that there is this covenantal process happening in Genesis 1. And I agree that there is. But there are layers. So I see Genesis 1 to 5 as being chiastic or symmetrical, but that is the picture on the box of the puzzle for the whole Bible. And so I see the pattern in Genesis 1 to 5, which follows the five Gary North's fivefold covenant pattern. Maybe should I cover that first?
If you'd like, yeah, you can maybe give us a little backstory on
Just
that.
quickly, I mean, and that's also the pattern that was seen in Deuteronomy, especially with Ray Sutton's book, That You May Prosper. But God's covenants have five basic steps, which is we find in everyday life. Number one, God is transcendent; he's the boss. Number two, that's transcendence, hierarchy; he puts somebody in charge as his representative. Number three is ethics, which is what he wants you to do. Number four is oath slash sanctions, which is getting you to agree, make an agreement, and and there will be blessings and curses depending on whether you carry it out or not. And the final step is succession, which is, when God comes back, basically the wicked get cut off and the righteous inherit what was promised. The succession is always about the future. So that's THEOS, which is a really good acronym. That's a lot of fun. That's
Yeah, that
nice.
is
And you
good.
can, you know,
Theos,
I used to get the high school kids to write Theos on their fingers. You know that, right? Okay. Now you see your thumb, how it's separate from the other ones? That's God's transcendence. He is separate. Okay. He starts off. That's it. He's separate. And then, the others follow. So Genesis 1 to 5 follows that pattern. So Genesis 1, God is the transcendent creator. He's above all. He's the one that is separate from his creation, but he's the source of everything. In Genesis 2 is hierarchy, and that's where God sets up humanity's basic structure. It's established. Marriage, children, the beginning of culture. Step 3 is ethics, which is Adam's testing and failure. So that's this, you know, he broke the law that God had given him. Oath and sanctions is where the outcome of Adam's sin affects society. So Cain's sin was the same sin as Adam's garden sin, but it was in the land, and now it was bloodshed. It was putting kingdom before priesthood. So, and then the final step is succession, and that's why Genesis 5, out of nowhere, gives us a genealogy from Adam to Noah, from the beginning of the world to the end of the primeval world. And it's a list of people. It's a list of deaths, as a friend pointed out. I thought, oh, I've never noticed that one before. It says, and such, and he died. Such and such, and he died. It just keeps saying died, 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 and then you said, and then the flood. You know, it's just like, whoa, okay, well, that's some succession there, some succession of death. You know, and it was funny because I just thought, I mean, how many times have I read that, and I never noticed that this one actually just kept mentioning death. You know, except for Enoch, which is another story. But so. That's THEOS, transcendence, hierarchy, ethics, oath and sanctions, and then succession. And there it is. That those five chapters are a little symmetrical, sort of a pericope, if you like. And that gives us the pattern for the whole Bible, in my opinion, because Genesis 1, I believe, is God establishing the physical order, the actual creation. Genesis 2, God establishes a human hierarchy as a representative of the world. And so Genesis, and people, you know how people say Genesis 1, Genesis 2 look like two separate stories? Like there's an obvious sort of a break. And think there's a bit of, it's like these two things have been put together. The reason is that Genesis 2 follows the same sevenfold pattern as Genesis 1. So you can actually line up the steps. So you have whatever is in a step, say step one in Genesis 1, lines up in a representative way with whatever's in that step in Genesis 2. So it's, you know, 1A, 2A, 1B, 2B, etc. And so you can actually see what is the local representative of the global reality in Genesis 1. And so that it's a deliberate interpretive device. That's why it's, you know, when there's something weird, you go, no, there's something else happening here. There's some logic that I'm not aware of. So that's what's happening. But so the point is that you have the physical order in Genesis 1, the social order in Genesis 2, the attempted establishment of the ethical order in Genesis 3, upon which everything hinged. And then coming back out of the symmetry, you have the social order corrupted, which matches step two and four in the symmetry. And then you have succession, which is the destruction of the physical order, which is a succession of death, and then the destruction in the flood. And so physical, social, ethical, social, physical. Okay, so stay with me.
Okay, I'm with
We're
you.
nearly there. Yeah, so I believe that in the Bible we have the same thing. We have a universal physical creational covenant from Adam to Noah, or to the Tower of Babel, basically, where everybody on the earth was in the same covenantal order. Some were blessed, some were cursed, depending on faith or unbelief, but they were all in the same covenant. So, sorry. And then when you get to Abraham, I believe it was to avoid another global catastrophe because things were going off the rails again. God splits humanity into two, in a sense, separating Israel. And this is the hierarchy step where God sets up a social model of the world. And as we see, especially under Moses, you have Israel as the land, and the Gentiles as the sea. And that's something Jordan brings out in his Revelation lectures, because whenever a revelation says the earth, it means the land. It's the land of Israel in that sense. And the Gentiles are the wild sea. And then when you get to Christ, then we have the ethical step of sacred history. Christ as a better Adam who obeys God, faces all the same temptations, and but also bears the sin of all humanity. And he's at the very center of the pattern of this same sequence, ethics. And then instead of the outcome, as in Genesis 4, where the outcome of that is bloodshed in society, the outcome in now in the, we're back to the social realm from the ethical realm. We now, but it brings the ethical with it. We have the Spirit of God who's actually reversing that in, men will be gradually turning their swords into plowshares. That's why Jesus gave us his flesh and blood, swords as bread and wine, plowshares. That's he's doing the opposite of what he's doing the opposite of what Cain did. So he's bringing peace through spiritual unity, spiritual fellowship. It does cause, obviously, the gospel causes division. But over time, that's the post-millennial view. Then the world is gradually becoming transformed. And then finally, at the last judgment, we have a return to the physical order. And so that's the important part there, where instead of having a succession of death that leads to the physical destruction of the world and the flood that was in that initial picture of Genesis 1 to 5, in the big picture, we have Adam to Noah as the physical order, the history of Israel as the hierarchy, as the social order. Then we have Christ bringing a new ethical order in the center as a better Adam. Then we have the church as a spiritual social order. And then we have the final restoration of creation at the end. So what Tim and JL do, they say, well, AD 70 and Revelation are clearly using world model language. The land and the sea refer to the Jews and the Gentiles. Therefore, if we go back to Genesis 1, the land and the sea must refer to people, the nations, etc. And that's not the case. That's the type. But my point is, there is a world model there, but it's not in Genesis 1. It's in Genesis 2. That's where the local representatives are. That's where God set up a representative human social order that stood before God as representatives of the global order. So when man sinned, the whole creation was affected. So sin did bring death into the world. So what they're doing, I think, is kind of missing the fact that there were these layers. The physical order is the basis. Then you come up to the social order. Look, it's like almost like going up a mountain in a sense, and then you have the ethical order at the top. And so there's this ascent from below to beside to above, to then beside, then to below in the flood. So I do think that what they've done is they've actually misaligned the end of the Israelite social order, the world model, the Jewish land and sea. They've misaligned that with what's in Genesis 1 instead of seeing it as a greater fulfillment of what was in Genesis 2, the social world model. So that's the problem. So I can see their point, but we're dealing with a three-decker model where it's a bit, well, that's what Jacob's ladder was. I mean, it's a ziggurat of representation. The closer you got from in Israel, from the lepers at the bottom, who were the unclean, they were like the creeping things because they had snake skin. That's what the leprosy was. It was like scaly skin. They were the snakes, in a sense, at the bottom. Not that there was no mercy for them, but that's what the leprosy was. And then as you, then you've got the common Israelites, and then you have the Levites, and then you have the priests, and then you have the high priest, and as you're working up this ziggurat of representation, it's getting harder. You're getting more and more purity required until the high priest he's Adam, and he's the one who is to be the most pure. And that also explains the Levites not having any land to farm. And the tabernacle virgins, who were voluntary virgins, so the Levites were bearing the curse on the ground in a symbolic sense, and the virgins were bearing the curse on the womb. And because they were around the tabernacle, that was the Garden of Eden, they were barren in that sense, and they had to rely on other people to supply those things. And Israel itself is a history of barren wombs. They Israel bore the curse on behalf of the nations, so the nations could multiply. So I think that's the solution to the covenant creation assertion, that
So,
it can it, Genesis 1 and 2.
sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to ask this
Yeah.
question. So with that in mind, so let me just ask you directly. So, with your understanding of scripture and the way that it is shaped, not only in the microcosm books of the world, but in the overall from Genesis to Revelation, is it your assessment that there will be an
Sorry.
end to our physical order and then be made new? Is that where you're heading? Are you saying that that's going to happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're consistent. If they believe that all scripture was fulfilled in AD 70, and then I believe they're cutting the end off of history, basically. There's no final end. And then it does make sense to go back and cut the beginning off of it. Well,
So
you
you would
know.
say that the covenant creationists are actually being more consistent in the full preterist paradigm because they're holding it to that same spiritual
Well,
fulfillment
that's
versus physical, right?
there's a symmetry there, definitely. The problem is they don't realize that AD 70 wasn't the end. It was just the end of the step two, like the social order. That was, I mean, it was the end of it began in with Christ, because he, there's an overlap, obviously. So they're kind of. They've got their chiasm misaligned. That's the center of history, the beginning of the new ethical order, so in a sense it's a lot of how can I put it? In the initial order of the world from Adam to Noah and a bit beyond, the order is physical, social, and ethical. And that, and then, but then, when you move to Abraham and to the history of Israel, the focus shifts to the social. It's circumcision was an ethical demarcation. The law enforced that ethical demarcation. Israel had obligations that the Gentiles didn't have. So there's a pri it's a social order that it's a dema it's a division of flesh in that sense. That's another reason why I'm not a pedobaptist, but that's another story. I see that. I see that as a purely ethical sign. It's not. There's no. There's social outcomes, but it's not a social demarcation like circumcision was. And so then it's the focus is it's physical becomes sort of secondary. It's more social ethical. Israel was a social demarcation with an ethical goal or telos. That the promises and the savior was coming. They were bringing the savior. Then you've got Christ, and even though he's a physical person and he's socially Jewish, the primary focus there is the ethical, because it's all about his true glory was the spiritual glory of his obedience to the Father. And so that's the ethical. And then as you come out to the church brings the ethical spirit, the spirit of Christ, into a new social order. So it's once again, it's sort of ethical. Now it's ethical social, which is the sort of the focus. And then the final restoration of creation is ethical, social, physical is the final thing, and that's the destruction of death. So I think they just kind of the layers are all related. As I like to say, they're linked, but they're distinct. And so the other thing you see in Genesis 1 to 5 is the pattern of world, land, garden, land, world. God created the world. He raises and forms Adam from the ground, from the land, lifts him up as a like a human first fruits into the garden. And then the action moves in Genesis 4 again out into the land. And then you have the first true king, Lamech, which is an anagram of Melech, king, and he's a bad guy. He establishes the practices for all later kings, murder and adultery, Well, that's what kings do, because number one, you have to murder your rivals, and you have to outbreed them. So polygamy was always about having more kids. It was like stealing fruit from God. I'm not going to wait for God to open the womb. I'm just going to have lots of wives. That's what they did, and so yeah. And then you have back to the physical. So world, land, garden, land, world. So I believe that's the once again the picture for the whole of history, where you have Adam to Noah was worldwide covenant, then Israel's history, there's a split. The covenant with Abraham, etc., functions within the Noahic covenant. The Noahic covenant was still operating. The Gentiles were still under that order, but Israel was representing them because the Noahic priesthood had failed. And so Israel's like a human shield, and they're bearing the blessings and curses on behalf of the whole world. So instead of God sending a flood of water, he sends a flood of troops. You know, as in, as
Yes.
I've noticed in Isaiah, it's like, yeah, well, I'm going to bring Assyria, and he's going to come in and cover the land up to the neck, so that, you know, Jerusalem will be like, huh? But you'll still be
Right.
able to, you'll survive, you know. So yeah, but only just, and then Babylon then comes in and is an actual, it covers absolutely everything, you know. And then Isaiah 44, I think it talks about God raising up, like drying up the rivers and raising Israel again from the waters, you know. So, but it's a metaphor, obviously, because the nations were the sea. And of course, when you get to the New Testament, it's all about fishermen, and that's because the
Right.
fish are the Gentiles, which, you know, that's, yeah, that's a common thing now, thanks to James Jordan. So it's world, land, garden, land, world. And so in that, looking at it from that perspective, they mess up by conflating the land language of Revelation with the world language of Genesis 1, whereas the land language actually corresponds with what's going on in Genesis 2, which is local representatives. So the world model thing is there, it's just not in Genesis 1. So.
Yeah, I mean, because honestly, and I appreciate that. That's one of the things that I learned when I was at the Covenant Creation Conference was that they were definitely seeing something in these structures. And if you say, again, for me to say that they got it wrong, the only thing that I've ever said is that I felt like they were back engineering the Bible, that the beginning is the physical order, although there are people like John Walton who have written books saying it's not about ex nihilo, but it's ex materia. Something was already there, and so it's being ordered by Elohim and all that. So, but I've always looked at it as kind of like a back engineering, kind of like when you mentioned the flood of troops, which is similar to what the flood of water was. Sometimes what I'll see are people take that idea, and when they read Genesis, they'll say, "Oh, that's actually not talking about water now; it's talking about armies." And so it's back engineering. It's not letting the thing that becomes the symbol that is used later have its day in court. It's got to have its day in court before it can actually be used later.
Well, yeah, that's right. There has to be an actual physical reality for there to be a local representative of it. So reading it back into it, you know, they say, well, Adam was called from among other existing people and made the head of, or attempted to be made the head of the covenant. I'd say no, that person who was called set apart was Abraham. He was set apart from the nations. So you're reading, even though there are typological correspondences between Adam and Abraham, Adam was given fertile ground and a fertile womb and promises. Abraham was given a barren womb and a barren ground, all the famines, you know, like Canaan was not a particularly good place at the time. And that's why Lot had to leave. You know, that's the other thing is like, oh, it's fertile down there. It's like this, that's the devil always saying, hey, you know,
Yes,
look at the fruit down there.
right.
It's the same story over and over again. Am I going to wait on God's blessing, or am I going to take a shortcut from the devil? You know,
Sure.
yeah.
I often
So
wondered,
that.
I've seen where, within the full preterist world, I know, again, I'm going to bring up Tim Martin. Tim Martin is a dear friend of mine. I love him and his family so much. They're wonderful, and I think he's a brilliant man. But he's actually challenged, other people within full preterists, particularly David Curtis at Berean Bible Church, in regard to his views of Genesis and his views of the eschatology of the scriptures. And he's challenged him. And I've often wondered if it would be better suited for someone like yourself, who or James Jordan, or somebody who actually is looking at Genesis in a similar light, the way that they are, but you have a structure that shows where to place it. That to me seems like that would be a better debate, because you're
Oh,
comparing
look, it's
apples and
and it's
apples.
it's the same. It's the same as the debate at, like, especially at the moment over like, you know, Gary DeMar looking at the inconsistencies within partial preterism,
Right.
And also and within the verses that were used to write the creeds. And I thought, you look, he's highlighting real problems,
Okay.
he's done a much more sort of a thorough job. But these I picked these things up as well before, especially looking at Mike, what's his name? Paul
Sullivan?
Pederisky.
Sullivan?
Yes.
Yeah, he's a good friend of
Yes.
mine. Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I guess we had a falling out. I mean, I just kept saying Mike, world, land, garden, land, world, and then he just kind of, that was it.
Yeah, Mike actually, I know he can be hard
Yeah.
online too. He can be hard online, but he's actually a genuinely sweet person, him
Oh,
and his wife
sure.
both.
No, and
Yeah, and
also
I
the
wish you
world.
guys could actually have a conversation and it
Well,
not go to blows.
we did, but it's just he. I think he just thought no, that we can't. The structure is not an answer. That was his decision, and but his work on at look just laying it out and saying, look, the language in this chapter is the same as the language in this chapter. There's no way they're talking about two different events. I'm like, yeah, of course, you're exactly right. So I mean, like I said, it's a group project, and everyone brings something. I think it was James Jordan who. Years ago, when he was looking at Romans 9 to 11, and he said, "Well, Don, I think it was Don Preston's work, but he said, look, Don Preston's a full preterist, so he has to force Romans 9 to 11, has to see them as being. I don't think they're forced. I think they has to see them as being fulfilled before AD 70." And he said, "You know what? I think he's right."
Oh, wow, yeah, that's good. You know,
and
that wow.
yes, yeah, so but the thing is, Preston came to that opinion because of his view on things, but I think within the that was that is within that context, and it actually makes a lot of sense when you read it that way. You suddenly just go, yeah, that's actually what's happening. And it just amazes me now that people can look at that passage and not see it. They say, oh no, I'll stick with the standard Reformed view that there will be a mass conversion. Look, there still might be a mass conversion of Jews in the future, but there's no, as Jordan points out, in God's eyes, there's no such thing as Jews anymore in any
Right.
covenantal sense. That there's no legal office of Jew as there was, and that's what it was. There's obviously ethnic Jews, and someone said, "Why do you think they are still around?" And I said, "Well, it's like Lot's wife, like there is a reminder. I mean, anyone can become Jewish and anyone can leave Judaism, but as an ethnic identity, it's still around because it's a reminder of the past. It's like a museum in a lot of ways, but it also is a sign that that was an office that God established. But I
You know,
don't think,
honestly, it breaks my heart what all that ethnic group have been through over the course of history.
yeah,
As a
exactly.
reminder,
Yeah.
they have really taken it, on the
Yeah,
chin for
and from
millennia.
Christians. It's funny though, because it's sort of, you love the people, and it doesn't matter who they are. You want to love the people, but you go hard on the doctrine, and that's what is difficult because people they don't seem to be able to sort of separate that.
I am one of those people who have a difficulty separating it because I live out my faith. I'm a very practical person, and the things that I believe, they operate in my world all of the time. So what you see is what you get. And so when I'm online or I'm in person, you're getting the same guy. So if you're like, you're an idiot, then all of a sudden, you might be saying what you're saying right here is idiotic. But you're not the idiot, but I'm taking it like, oh, so I'm an idiot. Now, I don't get upset and start lashing out, but I just
Oh
say,
no, I
you
just
know what I
meant sort
mean?
of more like, loving, say, loving Muslims, loving your Muslim neighbors, and yet being able to say, well, look, I'm sorry, what you believe is wrong. Like, there's just I have no qualms with saying that it's wrong. You're human beings, and I believe Christ died for you, and I'm going to love you in every possible way. But I would do that with anybody that's not a Christian. But also, it's with Judaism, it's a bit different because it has been given a bit of a free pass. And then when now that people are kind of digging into, the Talmuds and some of the stuff that's written in there. But once again, that's not mainstream Judaism. Like, there's some pretty shocking stuff. I just imagine a bunch of Jewish guys sitting around writing all this nasty stuff because they can, and it's like, and it's been preserved, but it's like most, I doubt whether many Jewish people have read it. It's
Right, sure. Can I
It's
ask
just
you one
not.
other question?
Yeah, you can ask.
I
I love questions. I mean,
okay.
I've got 6 hours, so you
Oh.
know.
Well, so I'll say this. In your estimation, in your understanding of the scriptures, can you tell me what is the significance of the removal of the temple and the city of Jerusalem by the Romans? Yes, we're going to say AD 70 or 66 to 70. I know you talk about, pushing everything into that position, but can you tell me what is the overarching thing that we should think of as believers? And did the church fathers understand it? Did the early patristics understand it? What happened in AD 70, and does it matter to what the Bible's talking about?
Yeah, look, I think it's crucial. I think it's the context of the New Testament. You can't understand, like, say, reading. I've heard so many sermons on parts of the book of Hebrews that they just miss the point because they're not realizing who it was written to and why. You know, also the other epistles. I mean, you know, when Peter was writing. He was mostly writing to Jewish Christians when he's talking about persecution, not entirely, but they were the ones that were really copying it from other Jews. That, you know, the Jewish rulers and the Judaizers are the big villains in the New Testament. You know, Nero doesn't come into the picture until AD 64 when all that stuff, when I believe the canon was finished. So, and even then, it wasn't Rome so much as Nero. That's one thing I've learned. It was Rome itself was like, But Nero is like, I hate these guys. You know, it was personal. You know, but you know, when Peter talks about persecution, one thing I've always wondered when he said, you know, we talked about Jesus going and preaching to the dead, and that's one of those things that you know Roman Catholics love to riff on, you know, write fan fiction about. Well, maybe the church fathers too. You know, there's the harrowing of hell, all this stuff. I'm like, actually, no. Thanks to James Jordan, I can see that in the fifth seal, where Jesus, after his ascension in Revelation 4 and 5, one of the things is he goes and preaches to the martyrs and says, "Well, it's nearly time." And they're like, "Well," and they're like John the Baptist in prison. They're like, "Well, okay, are you going to avenge us now?" And he's like, "No, not yet." There's, you know, like, but basically, because he's given Israel another 40 years, as Paul says, so they would not be cut off instantly like Sodom and Gomorrah. They're going to be threshed by the gospel, and that's a mercy. There will be a remnant saved, and also that will help bring the Gentiles in because, you know, they'll have time when they see the gospel going out, and then the Jews will be provoked when they see Gentiles believing, so more Jews will get saved. And Paul says, this is really cunning stuff. Like, God is so tricky, you know. It's like when Jesus mentioned Naaman the Syrian and the widow of Sidon, and they got really angry because he's pointing out these faithful Gentiles. How dare you? And then the Canaanite woman as well, you know, when Jesus says, "Well, why would I give the bread to the dogs under the table?" And he's been deliberately provocative. He's just like, sort of, you know, basically get lost. And then she calls his bluff, and she's like, you know, like, oh, that's not. I'm sorry, but you know, I'm not going to accept that. You know. And then he says, "Look at this faith." So, you know, he would say things to put people off. And that's where, if the Spirit of God is at work, no, they're not going to give up. They're going to like, no, I'm sorry, you don't get away with that. Like, so that's one thing I've noticed. That's a book that I've almost finished writing, which I've haven't really. It's been put on hold a bit. It's been a busy year. But it's just the ministry of provocation, where all the way through the Bible, you've just got people doing things to get people to expose who they are, and.
That sounds fantastic. I would love to read that.
Oh,
The, all the
but
provocations.
oh, well, I mean, you know, one of them, I believe, was Abraham. You know, when he knew that Pharaoh would have to, if Abraham said that Sarah was his sister, and she was his half sister, I think, then Pharaoh would have to negotiate with him for Sarah. But he didn't. He took her, and so Pharaoh exposed his heart, and God cursed Pharaoh. But it was a test. And then later on, people say, oh, and Abraham didn't learn. He did the same. He lied again with Abimelech. And it's like, no. He was testing Abimelech again. And this time Abimelech was a righteous man. And God said, hey, you know, like, this guy's. And then also with Lot offering his daughters, they go, how How could he do that? Like, Lot sat in the gate of the city. He knew these guys and they knew him. And so, he knew what they would say when he offered his daughters. He knew they would say no, but when they actually verbalized it and acted on that, that would condemn them. And I think it's because, it says Jesus knew their hearts, but he would say things to get people to reveal who they were so that when God judged them, there'd be no question of his justice. They would expose who they were. And the best example is Solomon when he says, cut the baby in half. And it always reminded me of a Brady Bunch episode, when they were growing up, when they had a, I think they'd had a car accident or something. And the guy that played Uncle Fester in the Addams Family played this man who was taken to court, and he had this big neck brace thing on and, whatever. And there's one scene where Mike Brady's off to the side and he just drops a suitcase on the ground, and the guy turns and goes, like that, and then they go, aha. And so he revealed that he wasn't injured at all, So, and then when Jesus said, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood, and people say, aha, transubstantiation. No. He was being deliberately provocative. Some people turned away, but others are like, no. There's something else going on here. And it's the Spirit of God that draws us. So I think that the ministry of provocation is a big deal, because sometimes God will hide his face and say something to, I mean, the Bible itself is like that. When unbelievers wrestle with the scriptures to their own destruction because they're just like, oh, what's he, but it, or they get to the point with where they read something and go, see, I'm vindicated, the Bible's wrong, or it's unjust, or it's brutal, or this, that, whatever else. I'm like, yeah, a believer's going to go, no, there's something else going on here,
That
and
is for sure. That is for sure. And I can also
they'll
say
keep looking.
the Good Samaritan to me is a very provocative, story, because automatically he's showing that the Levitical priesthood is not kind and compassionate, and and that, but the Samaritan that you hate, this racial slur that would come out of their mouths about these people, he's like, no, that's the one that you need to model after. That's very provocative, right?
Oh yeah, he just constantly pushed people's buttons, and I think it's because when there's peace, and that's something James Jordan brings out at the beginning of Zechariah, when the Lord sends the horses out and they come back and say, oh, everything's at peace, and that's, he said, the Lord is not happy with this peace because it's the peace of compromise. It's man's peace. It's not God's peace. God's like, no, I'm gonna, Jesus, like, I'm gonna bring a sword because this is not the kind of peace that is good. This is your solution. You have brought peace. It's a bit like Israel in Isaiah's time, where he describes them as being covered in scabs and all sorts of things and poor, and but they weren't at the time. They were actually really prosperous. But it's a bit like Laodicea, where he's saying, no, spiritually, the reason, and something I hadn't realized until fairly recently, was the reason that what the big reason for their idolatry and bringing an end to the false gods was trade. It's easier to trade with other nations, so it was basically selling out to for the sake of commerce. And so that's, Revelation picks that up when it talks about Jerusalem and her commerce, which is spiritual commerce as well, because of the people, the money changes in the temple. But the whole thing is compromised with Roman statecraft for the kind of maintenance of peace, which is not the peace that God brings. And so,
Would you say that Israel uses the same kind of compromising tactics to win a war or to win a fight? For example, whenever this other tribe wanted to intermarry with them, and then they said, okay, but you have to be circumcised to be a part of our thing. And so they circumcise them, and then while they're sitting there sore, they kill them all. You know what I mean? Like, they're
well, I
opposite of
mean,
compromise.
I think that was the Shechemites. Yeah, they and it's interesting because I'm not really the best with biblical geography. I've drawn quite a few maps for people over the years, and I've got a pretty good idea of where most things are now. Not the tribal boundary so much. That's just so complicated, and it kind of changes. But Shechem was right between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, which is where the blessings and the curses were pronounced. And Mount Ebal was barren, the curses mountain, was barren, and Mount Gerizim, it's green, you know, which is, it's just perfect, the blessings and the curses. So, you know, that happened later on, but it was the gateway into the land. And so you've got this terrible thing happening, where circumcision is used as a trap, in a sense. I mean, the Shechemites showed that they were honorable and they wanted to join, and they were quite, you know, the whole point was that they were, that was allowed later on, that your people could come and actually become, join the nation. You had to be circumcised and you would join the nation, and then you would inherit the promises. It's a bit like the was it the Midianite women, you know, people say, oh, it was sex slavery, you know, they took the virgins. I'm like, yeah, but they would have married them off to men who had a stake in the promised land. Like, you know, like that's not what was happening. These women were given an inherit, they were rescued and given an inheritance. So, you know, I think, no, I think that was just the idea of them being absolutely merciless, and it was a bad testimony. And it was only the Lord that protected Jacob's family by making them afraid of him. I mean, Jacob's response was right. He's like, you guys really messed up. Like, this is just, you know. And that's another thing, that the theme of intermarriage, which I believe begins in Genesis 6, and runs right to the end of the Bible. So when Jesus says, you know, it'll be as it was in the days before the flood, where they were eating and drinking the fruit of the ground promised to Adam and to Abraham, and marrying and giving in marriage the fruit of the womb promised to Adam and promised to Abraham. And so the idea is the difference between good intermarriage, like Boaz and Ruth, where the bride is a believer, she comes in, and the bad intermarriage, like those in Ezra and Nehemiah, who'd married pagan women who were raising pagan children, and they had to annul the marriages. And so, you know, the reunion of Jew and Gentile was like the devil's answer to the church, which was the faithful union of Jew and Gentile, was a conspiracy between the Jewish rulers and Rome as an alliance against the church, a spiritual alliance. That was his answer. It's like, well, if you guys are going to get together, I'll do the same thing. It's like Herod and Pilate becoming friends, and we're going to wipe Jesus out. You know, it's just the bigger version of what happened in Jesus. So intermarriage is another factor there. So the intermarriage with the Shechemites, I don't think God would have had a problem with it. I think it was probably early days, and it was probably wasn't it was probably a bit too early. There was still a tribe. It would have possibly confused things as far as the genealogies went, but it was still a terrible thing to do.
All right, here's my secret. I've been pretending to be a kitchen genius. You know, pans clanging, timers dinging, me yelling stuff like, "Chef's kiss." But in reality, it's all thanks to my secret ingredient. So let me break it down for you. First up, everything seasoning. And yes, I mean everything. And it delivers. Chicken, nailed it. Fish, incredible. Veggies, now there's your chef's kiss. Mashed potatoes, don't even get me started. And look, I've even pushed the limits with this stuff. I sprinkled it on popcorn. Amazing. I even tried it on squirrel. Do I regret it? Absolutely. Trust me, everything seasoning makes everything better, whether you're cooking gourmet or going a little off-road. Now, the main event, steakhouse seasoning. This isn't just seasoning, it's grill dominance in a jar. You hit a steak with this stuff, and suddenly you're channeling your inner Hank. Who's Hank, you ask? Hank's that flannel-wearing, boot-stomping, truck-driving king of the grill. He can chop down trees with his bare hands and grills a T-bone so good you'll want to slap Gordon Ramsay's mama right in the mouth. I grilled burgers with Steakhouse last weekend, and my buddy goes, "Man, I really need this recipe." And I shot him. No, I just told him that I'd leave it in my will. So if you're ready to cook like a legend and keep your secret weapon close, head to mysecretblends.com. That's www.mysecretblends.com. And use code Burrows, that's Burrows, at checkout for 20% off of your first order. So shake it, serve it, and when they ask you, just smile and say, "It's my little secret." My secret ingredient,
Get it today at www.mysecretblends.com and use Burroughs to get 20% off of your first order.
First of all, I want to thank you so much for being with me today and talking to me today. I've wanted to do this, and I would like to do a follow-up with you later. I think it would be great. I love just picking your brain. This is going to be great. But
Well, it's I've you know lots and lots of. I mean, any question. I mean, I love questions, but it's the attitude of like not the answer's here somewhere. And it has to be consistent with the rest of scripture. And it has to, and one thing I learned from Jordan is that these themes just come up. And there's one thing we've done with the Kenyan school, the notes for that is I think they got a bit tired of it because they said, oh, we just keep looking at these biblical themes. And I said, yeah, they're going to come in really handy because they're the things that are constant threads. And every time they come up, you need to be able to identify them again as part of the same story, because so often we look at things in isolation and we don't go, oh, okay, this is referring to something that happened back in season two, you know, and this is now season seven, and I'm trying to make sense of it. And it's difficult when, like, if you watch a long-running TV show and someone says something and they make a season a year and they're referring to something that happened 5 years ago, really. That's when you've got to go online and go, what did that mean? Oh, that was, you know, so the Bible's a bit like that. The Bible's written to provoke questions deliberately. It's, you know, God says things to deliberately make you go, what?
Yeah, it's the part of the relationship we have with them. Cause that I found that to be true, even in my own, just my life and just the way when I read the scriptures that it does. It does. Once the questions begin and you really start digging, that's when you really begin to know him more and more. So absolutely. Yep. Well, let's tell our listeners where they can find your work. So, because I'm sure that this has whetted their appetites to see what you're talking about. So where do they find the Bible Matrix and some of your writings?
Best place to go is biblematrix.com.au. Make sure you put the .au on the end, because I think there's a biblematrix.com that predates mine, but I don't know what that is. It's just some, yeah. So biblematrix.com.au. It's, I haven't been posting there a huge amount recently because it's there's a link there to all the books on Amazon as well. And there's a welcome page that'll sort of give you a bit of an intro. Currently working on a video course. I've been meaning to do it for years, but because I've been doing the notes for this Kenyan class, and there's this pastor in Kenya, Kennedy, his name is, who we met on Twitter on X about 4 or 5 years ago, and he's just as sharp as a tack. So he'd be, you know, asking questions, and he got a whole lot of really good theology books from an American missionary who was retiring, and he was reading this stuff and he said there was nothing, the Bible teaching in Kenya is pretty poor, like it's just, I mean, lack of literacy in some places, especially rural areas, has something to do with it. But he said, you know, there's a lot of people who think that just because they're gifted speakers they have the unction of the Spirit, and he said they preach things and then other people repeat them, and there's a bit of syncretism with, you know, sort of, I don't know about spiritism, but, and also there's prosperity gospel. You've got some churches, some preachers teaching that you need to keep the laws, some of the laws from the Old Testament. It's a real mess. So he said, I'm going to start doing some classes. So he's really the engine there, but me having a weekly deadline of writing notes means that I've actually been forced to put all this stuff together for a video course, which I'll be putting together next year. So it's been, you know, I reckon that's been the Lord cracking the whip saying, you really need to do this.
So consider, once you get that video course complete, would you consider coming back on the podcast and talking about it? And then so we can point them to it, because that would be good.
Oh, for sure. And it's mostly just assembling stuff that I've written, but because all of these people doing this course are already in ministry, And it's a real, there's a bit of a range of education and training there, but having an actual audience in mind has been really helpful for me to actually kind of target it. So, it takes you sort of through the basics of reading scripture, typology, symbolism, and the structure, and then we just sort of do a general sort of overview of the Bible. So the course in Kenya actually starts with a module that Kennedy mostly wrote, which is really just a survey of the Bible and basic doctrines and things that a lot of them don't have, and that's really helpful stuff too. But it made me realize how much we take for granted. But they're lapping it up. They are so hungry, like they're having a ball.
Yeah, I think
And
that's
they're
fantastic.
so keen. So yeah, look, I'd love to do that. It's probably going to be, there's a platform I found that's just really sort of come of age now, and they give you a classroom and you can put the courses on there and everything, and people can chat and stuff. So I think that's going to be the way to go, because there's always questions, and I really love questions because they it's a bit like a friend of mine who used to work. He was paid by a telecommunications company to hack into their system to find the holes. And they paid him to do it. And for me, when people question stuff, it's really good, because it's like, I hadn't thought of that. Does my system hold up? So yeah, questions are great. But yeah, I'd love to come back and talk again. That'd be good. And like as you can probably see, I could just talk for days, really.
Well, that makes you great for a podcaster. That's awesome. Well, if you would, Michael,
Yeah,
if you
but.
would, hang on. I'd like you to hang on. I'm gonna, as we end this recording, I'd like you to
Oh.
stay on with me and talk after. But guys, anybody who's watching this on Patreon, you can go into the show notes and you can see thebiblematrix.com.au to be able to see Michael Bull's work. And also, if you're listening, whether you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, it's also in the show notes. I've got a link there for you. Just click and you can go to it. I've already started that and it has been absolutely fascinating. You're not going to walk away from it very easily. It's very, very fascinating. So check it out. Michael Bull, thank you so much for being on the Burrows, man. It meant a lot to me, and I look
Good
forward
on
to
you.
having you come back once you have
Thanks,
your
Vic.
video
Yeah,
series done.
my pleasure.
All right. Well, you
Yeah,
take
good on
care.
you. Thanks, Vic.
All right.